Westwood One presents Pete Townsend, Off the Record with Mary Turner. Brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers. For all you do, this Bud's for you. And by the only jeans that shrink to fit you and you alone, Levi's Buttonfly 501 Blues. Pete Townsend, Off the Record.
They're trying to work out a Mingus tune at the moment. I've had to let the brass players do a few sort of Mingus things, you know, so that they don't rebel.
Pete Townsend with a brass section? Well, why not? He's got a new job, a new album, and a new film. Why not a new kind of band? I'm Mary Turner, and for the next hour, we'll visit the No Miss Rehearsal Studio in Hammersmith, England, to talk with rock's favorite philosopher, Pete Townsend, Off the Record.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Take my generation.
Once the Who were officially retired, you seemed a whole lot more relaxed. Was it a real big relief for you, not having to write another Who album?
It was divine. And it was only when it was done, finally done, and paid for, that I realised what a fool I'd been to actually try and drag it out. When Keith died, what we should have done was one show, one great big show, for Keith, for Keith's daughter and for Keith's mother and for his memory. Kenny would have come in and played, and we should have just one big concert. In fact, the first three concerts we did at the Rainbow and the were great. That's what we should have done. I think we went on because I wanted the band to go on. You know, I felt it was necessary for the band to go on. I was being very moral about it at the time, saying, you know, we should go on, you know, should go on, because otherwise people will blame Keith. Well, why shouldn't people blame Keith? Keith did wreck the Who. You know, he was vitally important to the band, vitally, and without him, we were not the same band. And I refused to accept that. And I think Roger was much more willing to accept that than I was. I felt that we could go on, and I think we were proved wrong.
Out here in the fields, I fight for my meals. I get my back into my living. I don't need to fight to prove.
When it ended, it was a terrific relief, and I've felt wonderful ever since. In fact, I've had much more than my fair share of happiness. I feel much freer. Rudolph Valentino, before he died, or committed suicide, or whatever it was, he said something, you know, I'm not in control of my life, you know, my life controls me, and this isn't good for a man, you know, he put it in a very macho way. I feel I'm in control of my life at the moment. If I want to do some gigs, I do them. If I don't, I don't. If I want to make a record, I make a record. If I want to go and work at Faber and Faber, I do it. I feel very much in control. You know, I can even choose to not earn any money. And, you know, for two years now, I've chosen not to earn any money. And that's been a great feeling too, you know, to go down to the kind of earning levels that most other people are at. Pinch and save and all the rest of it, you know, it's quite good for the soul, you know. And you suddenly realise, God, I'm 40 years old and I've spent 20 years as a real spoilt brat. So I've enjoyed the last couple of years very much.
The song is over. It's all behind me. I should have known it. Tried to find me.
Unless your radio has been broken for the past month, you've heard Roger Daltrey singing After the Fire, a Pete Townsend composition. It's the first thing Pete had written for Roger since the breakup of The Who. Obviously, the fire does still burn.
My ability to write for Roger is one which I hold very dear. And it was something that, of all the shards of glass that were left over from the Who, that's the one thing I really wanted to hang on to. I won't pretend that we meet for lunch every day, or that we're necessarily great mates or anything like that, but there's a deep, deep, deep love there. For a couple of arse like us, you know, I mean, you need all the friends you can get, basically. And we've shared so much, but I mean, mainly the thing is that I can write a line of lyric, and he seems to have a way of putting it across, fits, suits him, suits me.
You're alone above the street somewhere, wondering how you'll ever get out there. You can walk, you can talk, you can fight, but inside you've got something to write. In your hand you hold your only friend, never spend your guitar or your pen.
Your guitar.
And there's a joke, I don't know whether it will backfire or not, but I said to the guy who was doing the artwork, Richard Evans, at the very last minute, I said, actually, what, on the album cover, let's put White City, a novel. As a joke. Anyway, he did it. He actually put it on there. So I'm quite interested to see what critics make of that. Because that's really where the rock opera tag came from with Tommy, you know, it was like half a joke, which people took quite seriously. And I just thought it would be quite funny, you know, with me, my editor's chair at Faber and Faber, putting a record out, which I actually call a novel.
White City, coming up next on Pete Townsend, Off the Record. I'm Mary Turner. White City is a working-class suburb of London, not far from Shepherd's Bush, the neighborhood where The Who got their start. White City was also the inspiration for a new film and album by Pete Townsend.
The story is very simple. I started to drive through the estate on the way back from London. And one day I noticed that all the streets were called after sort of places in the British Empire, Australia Road, Canada Way. Then I saw that it was a rather sinister implication that quite a few of the names were connected with South Africa. Durban House, Bloemfontein Road, the General Smuts Pub. And I thought, aye, this is interesting, because I was very concerned at the time reading a lot about South Africa and apartheid. And I'm not, you know, I'm not one of those lefty individuals who just criticises South Africa out of hand. My reason, my passion for the problem in South Africa is because it's so close to ours, you know, as events recently have shown. Seems to me like a love story gone wrong, you know, like a country with so much potential, with this brilliant white community who are capable of earning millions. I know it's got a lot to do with gold, but it also happens that the South African money people, the financiers, are brilliant people. They're equally as good as the ones on Wall Street and equally as good as the ones in our city. Brilliant people, you know, it's another Hong Kong in a way. And this fantastic, rich, indigenous African population are separated. They're not even allowed to make love. It just seemed to me like, you know, a potential love story going wrong. And I thought I'd try a metaphor. A very simple metaphor. A couple who live on the White City estate who are estranged. They're prevented by some external circumstances from properly meshing together. And then the story grew from there. It's very, very simple, but it works, I think. In the film, the songs come in as a comment on the story. On the album, they tell the story. The album is not a film score. It's got a couple of songs even that aren't in the film. The film's just a 40-minute piece. It's quite short, quite pithy, and the album is normal length. It's not a concept album, really.
Don't bring me secondhand love.
in its purest form, in its most fundamental form, some would say, you know, that it's now old-fashioned, you know, it's a throwback. In its original form, that's all it's capable of, really, is doing something very, very simple. And as people try to push the rock song, try to get it to do more, what they find very rapidly is you go an inch too far and it stops being rock and it starts to become something else. It doesn't stop being music, it doesn't necessarily stop being pop, and it doesn't necessarily say that it's bad, but it definitely stops being what I define as rock music.
And he should know. He's a virtuoso with his guitar and his pen. But how is he on a word processor? In just a minute, we'll talk with Pete Townsend, author, Off the Record. Sticking Your Horse's Neck Out, coming up next on Pete Townsend, Off the Record. I'm Mary Turner, talking with Pete Townsend, Off the Record.
A love born once must soon be born again. A spark that burned then died, leaving cinders to be fanned by the wind and thrown to flame. Flames like tongues impassioned in a moment's burst. Tell me, friend, why do you stand aloof from your own heart?
I want to talk to you about your book, Horse's Neck. While reading it, I was thinking that a psychologist would have a real field day with it, trying to figure out what you're all about. Did writing that book help you to figure you out?
In a way, it might have done. No, I actually felt, when I started to write the book, I was quite sure about what I wanted to get down, you know? And the main thing that occurred to me was is that people that were reading a book by somebody who was in the rock business with a history like mine, they would have great preconceptions. They would imagine that there would be a particular kind of writing style, perhaps a kind of a mystical writing style or lyrical writing style or whatever. So firstly, I had to admit that people were not going to expect me to suddenly embark on some kind of cohesive novel form. But neither did I want people to feel that they were reading my life story. So what I did is I attended to that, the fact that, you know, that people would know me and would feel they knew me. So I had to look at what I thought the public thought I was about and then start to write. You have to realise that I started this book around 80, 81. So it was written throughout a period of rebuilding for me. And I think it mirrors that.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man, behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to tell in only lies.
I didn't write it to get great critical reviews. I didn't want to be described as, you know, the greatest new writer since such and such. I just wanted to do what I've done in my work in the last, particularly on solo work, in the last couple of records, and that's to actually not debunk my celebrity status or, you know, allow people to see something of myself which I feel I've been carrying on my shoulders or anything like that, but rather to let them know, let people that do feel things as deeply as I do, that everybody does. You know, some of the things that I've talked about are things that not many people talk about. And I think everybody, every human being, has a capacity for fantastically intense emotion. And as somebody who has taken, in my case, taken recourse to booze or drugs in the past, I know that, if in my case, hasn't been part of a pursuit of extreme emotion, but a way of escaping from the intensity of the experience that I have and the depth of which I feel things. Not everybody is like that, but there are a tremendous number of people that are. Somebody said to me once, what would you prefer, being happy and poor or miserable and rich? And I said, well, I'm pretty happy being miserable. I'd be pretty happy being miserable and poor. because I find quite a lot of enjoyment in the novelty, I suppose, of loneliness, as somebody who has very rarely been alone. I think at that particular time, my manifest outward miserable quality was because I wanted to be on my own. And I greatly resented at the time the fact that the band had to work, that I might have to plug the record by talking to you, or that I might have to go out and do this, go out and do that. In fact, even although I was very sociable at the time and went out a hell of a lot, I was quite happy to go to clubs with a group of people and then just abandon them, just walk around on my own, you know. And strangely enough, I think I got it right. I don't know why, I kind of knew that I was doing the right thing. I knew that I had to follow my nose. If I'd have tried to pretend that everything was all right, I think I would have had a proper breakdown of some sort. But as it was, I just kind of cruised through a fairly grey period.
Only love can make it rain the way the beach is kissed by the sea. Only love can make it rain like the sweat of lovers laying in the fields.
Rock has somehow more value when it's appealing to people who are hungry. I don't mean physically hungry. I don't think anybody's starving to death in this country, although there have been a few things recently I've read in the paper that indicate a few people might be one day. But hungry emotionally, and hungry culturally, and hungry for some kind of uplift. And rock, I think, is great at that level.
A hungry young man coming up next on Pete Townsend, Off the Record. I'm Mary Turner. You haven't planned any shows, really, for this album. Why don't you want a tour?
I've got no answer to that, really, apart from the fact that I would be fairly nervous about the thing running away, you know? The musicians that I'm using are, and they're very much like me in this respect, they play because they get a kick out of the danger of doing something. It's dangerous, you know, it could be a tremendous disaster, or it could be a wonderful day, you know, I mean, it could be great. Not allowing the thing to, not allowing the band to settle into a rut, you know, going out and doing just a couple of shows with quite a long list of stuff to do and quite a varied list of stuff. There's a certain element of risk about it. I suppose partly it's to see whether or not I can do it. But also, you know, with musicians of this class, you have to push them pretty hard to make them sweat, you know. I think the other thing, the other reason why I'm loath to do any more, really, is because I want to do this and then I want to really take stock. I want to see how it feels. I enjoyed doing the tube very much, although I was slightly disappointed with the sound. What's interesting is when we did the tube, I had to spend a night in a hotel. God, it was horrible. It was horrible. I mean, I just sat in this hotel room and it all came back to me. Perfectly wonderful hotel, you know, wonderful room service, films on the telly, comfortable bed, books to read and all the rest of it. It was quite nice to spend some time on my own and all the rest of it, but, you know, I think I phoned home about three times, you know. And my immediate gut response was to get a bottle of brandy, get stoned and go out into Newcastle and find a tart or something, you know, like something. It was like I was fighting that again. And I suppose really the main thing is I'm not sure whether I'm strong enough yet to do it.
After all these years, are you still a big believer in the power of rock and roll to make a difference in the world?
I haven't lost my passion. any more than I think you have. I mean, if I was to wake up one morning and find that I really believed that rock music was not capable of doing something substantial, of tremendous spiritual uplift, I would find that deeply, deeply depressing. I'm just now quite resigned to the fact that I can't do it. You know, I love jazz, I like classical music, I like poetry, I like reading, but I never feel, I like movies, I like all kinds of things, but I never feel as free and as anarchic and as liberated as when I'm listening to good rock and roll. You know, it's a spark in me that is still there.
I stood at the door beside her, but she wouldn't let me pass. I was such a bore and I lied to her. I said I didn't really want her ass. I went away in the mud and rain. The gang became snide and laughed. I was late, but I smiled and the pain began to subside at last. And when I got back to my hotel, I wondered if the fundamental...
Pete Townsend, Off the Record with Mary Turner, has been brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers. For all you do, this Bud's for you. And by the only jeans that shrink to fit you and you alone, Levi's Buttonfly 501 Blues. This special program was written and produced by Marcia Richeson. Production and engineering by Bill Levy. Off the Record with Mary Turner is a presentation of the Westwood One Radio Network. Executive producer, Norm Pattis.